Hello, hello, hello. I am your Melissa King, hostess with the mostest, Michael Munoz. And welcome to In Yo Mouth.
In Yo Mouth.
I'm the queen of food who's always in the mood.
To lick it right, lick it good, show you how to
look. Oh, God, that's good.
I want to know what you eat from the streets to the sheets.
So open wide, honey.
I'm coming.
In Yo
Mouth. I got the goosebumps.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Hey there, and welcome back, folks. Once again, I am your hostess with the mostest, Munoz, and we are trucking along through March. Yep, I said it, and I'm just gonna play Father Time at this point. It's all moving a little too fast for me, and the weather here in New York has been crazy. You know, this week, you know what kick I'm on this week? I'm trying to date more, and what does that mean? I've been single forever, but like dating and just dating hasn't ever really been a reality, and it's so hard in New York City. You would think it was easy because, you know, there's like 8 million people here, but no, it's a mess. These men are a mess. I went on a terrible date, albeit he was 24. No shade to you 24-year-olds out there. I'm just a lady of a certain age, and we're just at different places in life. And this person all but asked me what my favorite color was. I was like, oh, get me out of here. The joyous part about it is that it's all centered around food, kind of. So it's a great way to explore new things. And speaking of exploring, I am really excited for today's guest. And maybe she has some opinions on dating in New York City, because Lord knows I could use every little bit of help I can get these days. So without further ado, please help me welcome the one, the only, Chef Hannah Wong. Say hi.
Hi. So happy to be here. Let's talk about dating.
Oh my God, right? You were like, why am I on a food podcast talking about dating?
There's so, I mean, you know, if you work in food, your life revolves around food, and thus like dating revolves around food. And also I hear you. Definitely.
Yeah, right. I mean, I always call it, at least with gay men in this city, I call it the New York slots, in the sense of, oh yeah, you're great. You're great. But maybe if I pull like the handle one more time, I'll hit the jackpot. Maybe you'll have blue eyes, or maybe you'll have abs, or maybe you will be from the same town in Ohio or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just because the options are so bountiful that, like, oh, I can gamble this one more time. You know?
Right, for sure. Yeah.
I don't know. Any thoughts or opinions on this?
Well, I mean, as you probably know, I moved out of the city a couple of years ago. But while I was there, because I was working in food the entire time that I lived in New York City, it's kind of a weird thing where people are like simultaneously attracted to what you do, because there's like a, you know, a kind of like fiery energy that a lot of chefs can, you know, obviously
they're
passionate. It's so sensual, like you working with your hands doing, you know, so I feel like there's something very attractive about that to other people. And also like they're like, fuck this, you're not free on Friday, Saturday and Sunday. Like, you don't have nights. I mean, you know, it's so limiting logistically. So, so I don't know. I mean, I think I've been pretty lucky in my life with the people that, I've surrounded myself with, but it's definitely challenging for, and it doesn't get old, you know, it's every, you know, as for as long as you're a chef or as long as you're in the industry, the hours are not going to change. So
yeah, absolutely. I don't know. It's just, you know, in a city of like millions or however many people are here, you'd think it would be a lot easier. And this year I've kind of, you know, I have kind of really resigned myself to being like more social, more out there, you know, and more present in social spaces away from the phone and the social media of it all.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we'll leave that for now. We're already unhinged and off track, and it's a complete vibe. Well, I am so happy that you're here, and thank you for giving me of your time today. But before we get anywhere, I got to do what I got to do. And in the grand tradition of In Yo Mouth, I need to wish you happy National Peanut Cluster Day. Peanut Cluster Day.
It's a good one.
Last
good
week
holiday.
Was National Peanut Butter Day. Right? This week, it's National Peanut Cluster Day. Why do peanut clusters need a day?
I don't even know. Is that a candy? What is a peanut cluster?
I think it's
an orgy? It's a peanut orgy. It's with caramel.
Right? Oh, yes. It's like the peanuts with the caramel, and they're covered in the chocolate, you know?
Okay.
And
they kind of look like
cow pies or whatever. They kind of look like poop.
I can't say I've had one, but maybe that's the day. This is the day.
This is the day for peanut clusters? I mean, are we big into peanuts?
I love, you know, I think peanuts are really versatile. I do love them. Reese's peanut butter cups are like my favorite candy. But as far as using them in other culinary applications, I think they're really versatile. They add a lot of fat and body to things like sweet, salty, you know, across the spectrum. I think, stews, like sauces, you know, like texture on a dish. It's so, you know, they're very humble ingredient that I think deserves a lot of love. So I'm glad they're getting this day.
Humble and underrated, the underrated peanut. Right?
Uh-huh.
Well, I guess no matter what you celebrate today, whether it's Peanut Cluster Day, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, or just peanuts on the side of the street, I don't even know. Today we celebrate you. And moving right along into this day in gay history, which is very apropos today. Did you know, Chef Hannah, that in 1970, in the wee morning hours, New York City police raid a gay bar called the Snake Pit, arresting 167 patrons. At the police station, one of the arrestees, an Argentine national named Diego Vinales, so feared the possibility of deportation that he leapt from a second-story window of the police station, impaling himself on the spikes of an iron fence. Eek. He survived, though the firemen were forced to cut a section of the fence with Vinales still skewered on it in order to move him to the hospital. One journalist remarked, "It is no crime to be in a place that is serving liquor illegally. The only crime is to run such place." And I thought this was really interesting. Mm. Just a really interesting tidbit of history, seeming how there's like over, what is it, like 500 bill, anti-LGBTQ bills being proposed these days, and like this crazy bill in Tennessee where you're not even allowed to be, you know, in drag in bars that may pass. It's a crazy world we live in, but not very much different than what's happening not that long ago.
No, it's not. I know. I mean, it is terrifying to walk out the door some days, but I feel like that's why it's so important to have our community and to stand by our communities and support each other through all this ridiculousness.
All this ridiculousness. And this is why I keep bringing up these little, you know, factoids every week, because our history is important, because albeit long, right, and sometimes unrecorded, you know, we're still living in it, you know. So
for sure.
That's that. Well, shout out to all the gay activists out there fighting the good fight. We stand with you today. But I want to get to the getting on. And in your mouth, listeners, if you don't know, and you probably already do, Chef Hannah Wong has worked in New York City since graduating culinary school in 2012. After beginning her career at Daniel Boulud's DB Bistro Moderne, she worked at highly renowned restaurants Gramercy Tavern, Delicious, and Battersby, while also doing stints in private events and catering. In March of 2019, Hannah partnered with Yen No of Real Food Catering to open Van Da, a modern Vietnamese restaurant in the East Village. Inspired by owner Ms. No's childhood in Vietnam, Van Da was well-reviewed by The New Yorker and The New York Times and received Bib Gourmand recognition from the 2020 Michelin Guide. At the beginning of the pandemic, Chef Wong pivoted to working with organizations that help communities fight food insecurity. Most recently, you can find her upstate in the Hudson Valley, wowing the crowds at her all-day cafe, Morning Bird, and her restaurants, The Avery and The Nest, in the Kinderhook Knitting Mill. Welcome.
Thank you. Wow.
Welcome. What?
That was thorough.
It was. Well, listen, we gotta give the credit where credit is due, right? I like that reaction. What's it like hearing that back?
You know, it does. It's good. It's good perspective on. You know, sometimes when you're working these hours and the intensity of everything, you kind of lose track of time. You lose, you kind of lose a little bit of perspective when you're just kind of grinding it out. So it's nice to like step back and be like, oh yeah, like I was there and this happened in my life around this. And it's good. It's good to see it kind of as a cohesive, you know, some kind of cohesive arc. It's a good feeling. I mean, I feel like there's that journey kind of, when I look back on it now, cause I'm a little bit older, I feel like those steps in my life it makes sense where I am right now based on like everything that kind of happened before. So there's a nice feeling, you know.
And you've certainly made your mark, left your mark, and are continuing, as I can see, right from all my deep diving, to leave a mark, and a very important one at that. But I always like to start at the love of food. Where does your love of food come from?
I feel like that's a very complicated question. Both my parents are immigrants from Hong Kong, and my father, when he moved to New York City, worked in a restaurant to put himself through college and continued to work in restaurants for a while. And, you know, so I grew up, when I was growing up, I always came home to a 3-course meal for dinner. You know, it was home cooking. It was very classic Cantonese home cooking, but it was, you know, like a whole fish and like a beef or a chicken or something and rice and soup always and a vegetable, you know, it was like, I didn't realize that people didn't eat like that. Like that kids didn't eat like this until I get to college and I meet all these, you know, I went to college in Western Mass. It was very different demographic from what I grew up. I grew up in a very, Eastern Asian community. And so I got to college and people talk about what they grew up eating and I'm like, what? Like cream cheese on white bread? And, you know,
all of a sudden the Kraft mac and cheese boxes start coming out.
Right. And I would come up with, you know, we'd stop at the Korean store on the way up and I'd get these like microwave rice bowls with kimchi and seaweed and like anchovies so that I could have, you know, I still have some food that was, you know, that I was familiar with, more familiar, you know, that kind of reminded me of home. I felt like food was for a lot, as it is for a lot of kids growing up, I think, especially from, immigrant first generation households, food is a way for parents to show their care because there's not a lot of, oftentimes I feel like there's an emotional disconnect, you know, it's hard to relate to each other cross-culturally, cross-generational, language barrier, you know. So with all the conflict and tension and difficulty in connecting in these kinds of households. I feel like food is often the one thing that really doesn't is there's not really a barrier there, right? You can really, you don't have to be able to verbalize or articulate the feeling. You can just kind of show it through the food. And so food. I think and that.
And there's something to be said about just the taste of home, you know, in that sense, coming from like, you know, culturally rich backgrounds that are like centered around the dinner table. Like you, like me, you know, I recently went out to dinner with my brother at a Puerto Rican restaurant. And as we were sitting there, and it was delicious, so we were sitting there, I was like, oh my God, I haven't had, like, because I don't cook Puerto Rican food like that just because of my gay body dysmorphia and everything. You know, it's usually high in fat and delicious. But I just remember sitting there and, like, absorbing the moment that it tasted like home, and it reminded me, and it was like this flood of memories. And I was like, oh my God, this was delicious, you know? And it's like, like, oh, I need to connect with this a little bit more. You know, it was a nice reminder.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, no matter, I don't know about, you know, your struggles growing up, but, I feel like that pleasure around food that you experience as a kid, or even later in life, I feel like there is a kind of like purity of it. It's because it's so primal, right? It's so, I don't know. It's just, it's so much about the sensory experience to me. And I feel like there's a purity of that, feels like so just refreshing and simple and uncomplicated. And, that to me is like, you know, despite all of the shit that can happen as a kid or in this world, being able to enjoy food. And I think oftentimes, ideally, with the people that you care about and love, it kind of distills a certain pleasure in life. You know, that is to me, that's very meaningful.
Yeah, absolutely. So where was that moment for you? Because you weren't always on a food journey. Where was that moment for you that like kind of clicked that you were like, oh, I really need to be doing this, right? Because a lot of what I read about you is like building community through food. But like, when did the switch flip for you?
Well, I got into cooking because, I felt like I always had an appreciation of food as a consumer. Mm-hmm. I had from a very young age, but. And when I was traveling after college in Southeast Asia, that's when I really started making this connection between food as a vehicle for, you know, receiving different kinds of cultural knowledge and just experiencing a place through food. And that got me really excited. And then when I was working in publishing, you know, I realized that I think that's when something happened to me. I was feeling like, I don't think my body is meant to be in an office chair, you know, for 8 hours a day. And as much as I loved the intellectual stimulation of that kind of environment. And, you know, I thought I was going to grad school or maybe be a lawyer. Like I thought I was on this kind of track, and I realized my body was just suffering though. I've realized, and I kind of, this was a period in my life where I was like deeply unhappy. And I felt like a lot of it was because I wasn't using my body in the way that I think I needed to be. And so I started working at this restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I was living on the weekends, just, you know, helping out and expediting and hosting. And I kind of fell in love with the environment. And there was a night where I realized, you know, that I felt like I really had to make a drastic change in my life in order to kind of survive. Like I felt like if I continued doing what I was doing, that was not going to end well for me. So I literally applied to culinary school the next day. I mean, I grew up with a chef as a father, but I never was allowed into the kitchen because it wasn't really a career that he thought or my parents thought was respectable or kind of what they wanted for me, right? They wanted me to not be a blue collar laborer, I think. And so, but I don't know, like, you know, I don't know where that intuition to apply to culinary school came from. It was, you know, I don't know where it came from. But I knew that I had to just like make a very drastic change in my life because, I was so unhappy. And so yeah. I did that. And I realized, you know, as soon as I stepped into a kitchen, I realized like that, damn, I like feel so alive. Like I feel that this is the most alive, I've ever, you know, like so in my body and like, so just locked in and you have like the intense, like mental, you know, the energy that is also involved in cooking, which I love. You develop these habits through like routine and practice where your body has, you know, it kind of like can move on its own. But then, you know, as you get on in your career and I think, you know, maybe tap into a little bit more creative energy, you know, there is like a dance between your body and your mind and, you know, what's happening inside the creative energy or inspiration that you're bringing at all. It's kind of, I think the last couple of years for me have really been especially exciting because I feel like all of these things are really, you know, kind of cohering in a way that is translating to the food and also to the community building.
Yeah. You speak about this, like for me, the words I'm putting into it, like this divine intervention that you needed a drastic change. Right. And so, and how beautiful that journey is. And as you were speaking, it got me thinking as well that the correlations of how you were feeling just in life in general for work-wise and how that is like almost side by side parallel to coming out, right? And not feeling grounded in yourself and mm-hmm. and knowing that like something needs to change so that way I can really feel like in my body, in, you know, mm-hmm. together. Would mm-hmm. you agree?
For sure, yeah. That's an interesting comparison because I feel like, you know, when I just told you my story,
yeah,
there was like I can remember to this day, like a very particular moment in time where I was like, okay, this really has to change like right now. Whereas I think for me, my experience with coming out, and I don't even really know how to, I still haven't really learned how to create a story, like to tell the story of it to me. I still, first of all, it's still in process, right? I think
it's a never ending process. Yeah.
And I think I still struggle sometimes with kind of how to talk about it neatly because I think it is super messy, or it can be, and mm-hmm. and not linear, right? And
Absolutely.
So I feel like I grew up in a very religious household and I had no concept of queerness until I got to college and I fell in love. And at the time, I guess I didn't really think of it as like falling in love with a person who happened to be a woman, you know, and I was I don't think I quite realized how to be queer at the time because I was just, you know, I just started dating people. I didn't know what queerness was as an identity or what queer community, you know, I didn't really seek those things out in the first, you know, maybe 5 years that I was coming into that queerness. I think it was because like you were saying, I felt like there was so much to figure out internally. And until you really kind of feel grounded, I think in your internal, what's happening for you internally in your body, I think for me and my experience, I think I needed a lot of time to develop that kind of confidence in my identity and what I was doing with my life and the people I was surrounding myself with before I could even, you know, think outward about, okay, how do I like represent myself as a queer person to, at work or like with my family or, you know, whatever. And, that to me is, I think when people talk about coming out or when people who aren't queer, who haven't gone through this process for themselves, think about it. Sometimes they think about it as only internal, right? You have a process that you're going through internally, and the coming out is just like the release into the world. But I think there's so much like of this toggling that you're doing where there is a lot of internal struggle or, you know, a process. And there is like the external, how do I communicate this to people or how do I present and all that. But it's like this back and forth. Yeah. It's so not streamlined. You know,
absolutely. There's no rule book about it. What was the key for you to figuring it out then?
I think for me, I feel like it's just been about learning to love myself. Yeah, I don't mean for that to sound all like, you know.
It's hard. And we don't, you know what? I forget what I was reading the other day about like loving yourself and whatnot. And you don't even realize, like I do it all the time to myself, even on this podcast. I mentioned my gay body dysmorphia, right? Because it's a little self-deprecating. And it's like, oh, we could change that language. Mm-hmm. Or like looking at yourself in the mirror, like when you go to the shower and you're like, maybe I shouldn't look in the mirror for a couple of weeks. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But those are like microaggressive, if I may use that, like negative things towards yourself that it's not necessarily loving. So that's hard to, sometimes it's hard to do when we realize we're not being kind to ourselves.
Yes.
Like we don't realize we're not being kind to ourselves, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And I think what I also meant when I said that, you know, that loving myself, loving your, you know, that is the key to coming out, because I think coming out requires, I don't know if confidence is the right word, but like a kind of certainty in what, or like a certainty or a security or some kind of like, I'm here and I'm queer and this is, you know, this is part of the story. It's not all of it, obviously, but like, and in order to be grounded in that kind of like, you know, putting yourself out there like that, I think you do have to have like, you have to not be self-hate, like you have to be okay with it. And I think that for anyone, but I think for people especially who maybe come from religious homes or, you know, homes where families aren't comfortable with that or don't have a lot of experience with it, there's so much like self-homophobia that you have to conquer in order to come out to the world. So I hadn't thought about that in a minute, because now I just, you know, I think bless the people that came before us who fought for our ability to like move through the world in many places in America, and like sadly not all of them, but to be able to move through the world at times and not even have to think about it all the time, you know?
Yeah. And but this is also the joys of it. This is what brings me joy, and this is why I do what I do on this podcast, is talking. Yeah, we can sit here and talk and shoot the shit, right, and laugh about dating and whatnot, and like talk all things about food, right? You can give me all the info, right, about the most delicious things that you're doing, right? But like, it's this connect that we as LGBTQ people, especially in the food space, right? And we talk about a lot about like toxic kitchen culture here and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Don't often have the space to commune like this, you know? Like, yes, food is the great unifier. And yes, like, you know, everybody's a foodstagrammer these days. Mm-hmm. And yes, like, but like connecting like this and hearing these stories and like connecting it through food and what we're doing, right, is what really brings me joy, you know? And and hearing all these stories and hearing these opinions and hearing the journeys, right? Because 5 years into it, I've heard so many, right? Mm. And not a one is the same, right? Mm. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful, and it's sometimes bittersweet, and sometimes it's sad, and sometimes it's like you get the full spectrum.
Yeah.
Of what it is, right? And so it just brings me joy. So thanks.
Well, thank you for being a queer food-centric storyteller.
You know, I've been deemed the Andy Cohen of food. I don't know if I can still use that anymore. Right? But sure, right? Like, and y'all are my Real Housewives, right? Well, listen, Hannah, I think now would be a great time for you and I to take a break, maybe taste something delicious, and maybe have a cocktail. And we're going to be right back with my favorite part and the audience's favorite part of the podcast.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Okay, Hannah, I hope you're ready for my favorite part and the audience's favorite part of the podcast. A little something we like to call Food News Update. Food News?
Ooh, honey, you ain't ready.
Girl, spill the tea.
News Update.
Shake Shack's Truffle Table will turn your next burger night into a fine dining experience.
Oh, man. Shake Shack. Truffles, I love. No one can handle truffles, but there's a time and a place for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and it's not at the Shake Shack fucking, you know.
There is a Shake Shack right outside my window. There's also a Smash Burger right outside my window. There's all sorts of things outside my window. And you know what? Albeit greasy and delicious, I can't eat it. It ruins my life.
Mm-hmm.
It really, really ruins my life. So apparently, like a week and a half ago, Shake Shack restaurants across the U.S. transformed one special table in their shop into an upscale dining setup. And it was, apparently it has a white truffle menu. And so the prefix menu included a white truffle burger, white truffle shroom burger, and Parmesan fries with white truffle sauce. It's too much truffle.
It's too much truffle. And who's going to Shake Shack who wants truffles?
Like, and what, you know, like, what are we doing here?
Fast casual is so ridiculous sometimes.
It really, really is. I mean, can't you just... You do one thing fairly well.
Right.
Why do we need to... Why do we need to, like, sign up for the gimmicks, you know? All of this clocked in at just $20 per person, though. So, like, they made it affordable. So are they actually using real white truffles? Mm. Or is it essence of? Because you know as well as I know that if we're going for a truffle situation anywhere... That ish is expensive as all get out.
For sure, yeah. $20 for all of that, I'm thinking it's coming from a bottle, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right? Right? I don't know. You know what? The other day, well, not the other day, like a couple months ago, I went to Trader Joe's and they had, I don't often buy jarred sauce, but like, you know, sometimes I'm so busy and then you buy the jarred sauce and then you have to doctor the jarred sauce. And one of their sauces was like some sort of like truffle sauce, and it sounded good on paper. It tasted like soap because there was so much truffle.
Mm-hmm.
It was gross.
I mean, I feel like truffles are, it's not, they're a flavor bomb, but I think you have to know how to, you know, have to have like, you have to know how to utilize them. You can't just be heavy-handed with, you know. It's not like the more is better, you know, with them. And we did an event actually in December with two of the loveliest people ever in food. And I don't know if you've ever had them on your podcast, but they're so incredible. Rita and Jody from Via Carota and Isodi and all those, and Bavette. But they came up.
All those places you can't get into.
They did an event with us in December and brought some black truffles up, and we used them for a bunch of things, and they were incredible. But I, you know, it was incredible to see. It's always incredible to see chefs respect ingredients, you know, and be very, you know, not. I think people think truffles are like gold sometimes, and there's a kind of a silly reverence for them, but I think they kind of were like very chill about it. They were, right, you know, they right. were like, let these, me, yeah, go for
present,
it. Yeah.
Let me present this to you then, totally. And then we're going to move on.
Okay.
But, you know, cause truffles are so revered and so, like, you know, have this like umbrella of fancy schmancy to them, right? To keep it real low key here. Is this then making it accessible to the masses?
I'm all about, yeah, totally. I'm all about leveling the playing field and making food accessible for sure.
But did I take it too far with the fast casual?
Well, I just want to make sure. I mean, I'm very curious about what those dishes at Shake Shack tasted like, because if they actually like represented truffles in a way that makes people be like, oh, this is actually like, man, I could get into this, or like this is like an ingredient that I should like look for more or whatever. But if you go to a store and buy like truffle mayo and it tastes like soap, you're never going to want to, you know, try a truffle again. So exactly. Yeah.
I took it to a very serious place about food inequality here. So
you did. I thought this was the fun part.
Well, I think you and I are on the fence about this. I don't know. We're neither here for it nor not here for it. I'm getting the sense
I think that's right, yeah.
I think we can leave it just there.
Cool.
Sir Kensington's ketchup is being discontinued. Womp, womp. Did you hear about this?
I didn't, but I can't imagine. I just don't believe in any other ketchup besides Heinz. I really don't.
So are we a ketchup stan? I'm off the ketchup. I will eat it.
Oh, I love it. No, I love it.
I will eat if it's there, but like... anything else. Give me chipotle, aioli, ranch, anything but.
I like a double sauce situation. Like I'm a ketchup and something else, right? So if
maybe
I
maybe ketchup mayo, like, yes. Because I'm Puerto Rican, hello. But like
ketchup mayo on a burger. Yeah. I mean, yeah, for sure.
Delish. But like I'm kind of like, it's too sweet, mm-hmm. right? But this is what makes it sad, because Sir Kensington had a little bit more flavor depth. So it's sad that it's going away.
I see. Yeah. I guess I when I open a bottle of ketchup, I'm not looking for depth of flavor. Like I'm looking for that slightly sugary, like fake tomato kind of, and sometimes I'll add like Tabasco or something, you know, sometimes
delicious.
I'll doctor it.
Yeah.
We'll go semi homemade. But like, I really just like to pour, like, do a little ketchup on my eggs sometimes.
Yeah, like basic. Curried ketchup.
Yeah, curry delicious. For sure.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just, you know what? I was a fan, although I'm not a huge fan of ketchup these days, I was a fan of Sir Kensington's ketchup. It was just tomato-y and not that like high fructose corn syrup sweet, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. It was very, very delicious. But apparently, because of low margins, the sale of the company, and a refocus on its more popular product, Sir Kensington's mayo, they're discontinuing the ketchup, even though it was their product that launched them.
But this is the thing, right? I don't feel like there's so many competitors in like mustard and mayo and other condiments, and ketchup is the one I feel like it's a thing. Like you can't beat people, and it's not about the flavor, because I've never yeah. had Sir Kensington's ketchup, but I believe you 100% that the flavor is great. But no one who's like going down the ketchup aisle, it's all about nostalgia.
Yeah, it's all about the Heinz, right? Or, oh my God, or French's, because French's made ketchup. We used to have French's on our hot dogs,
nice.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? Well, I don't know if we're here for, I mean, I guess we're here for ketchup. It's sad that, I mean, but Sir Kensington's is fine. They're still making money off of all this mayo.
Their mayo's bomb. Their mayo's great.
The mayo's good. So, like, shout out to you.
They're doing fine. Yeah.
Yeah, they're fine. They're fine. Right? Like, let's... And last but not least, your rescue pet could become the new Cadbury mascot. Now, do we like Cadbury eggs? I can't tell you when the last time I had a Cadbury egg was.
Same. I mean, I'm a little I'm it's not because I work in food, but I'm a little particular about chocolate, and it's not something I crave a lot. But I did tell you, and just the beginning of the podcast, that Reese's peanut butter cups are my favorite. So
I was like, wait a minute, are we a chocolate snob? Because I know I heard something about Reese's.
We're definitely, well, what did Walt Whitman say? We're full of contradictions, right? Multitudes of contradictions. I don't know.
Right. Have you ever had Tony's Chocolonely?
That is my favorite chocolate.
Oh my God, it's so good. Not a sponsor, but that purple one, the dark chocolate with the pretzels and the toffee.
Oh, I haven't had that, but I'm a lookout for it today.
Oh my God, it's so good.
I like the, I like the green and the orange flavor,
I think one of them is like a
toffee. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll look for the purple one, but the toffee one is good too. I think it's milk chocolate and toffee.
But we were just talking about nostalgia, and what's more nostalgic, right,
than Cadbury?
Than Cadbury, and that famous commercial that's been running how many years now? At least like 50 or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? And I didn't realize that. I'm thinking about this now, because that bunny box, it sits there and it's like buck 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 buck. Do rabbits buck? I thought that's like chickens.
Oh my God! I don't know.
And then like that big lion is like buck. Right? Do they bark?
I don't know.
Do you own any pets?
Chocolate rabbits? What is the sound that chocolate rabbits make?
I don't know. Why do they got to be chocolate rabbits?
That's true. I have two cats actually. So,
Are they rescues? Because they could be rescues. They could win.
Yeah, no, they're a funny story, but that's for another time, maybe.
Cadbury is hosting a nationwide search for a shelter adopted pet so it could find that star destined animal. Why rescues? According to a statement provided to Food and Wine, it was a decision made in honor of Cadbury's partnership with the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, the ASPCA. And you can enter by just submitting a cute photo, and you could win $5,000 for yourself and then $5,000 for an animal shelter of your choice.
What? I might actually do this. You just have to submit a photo?
Yes, of your rescues. Photo.
Yeah.
Think of your pet. Think your pet has what it takes to be the next cream egg basket carrying star. To enter, pet parents can visit CadburyTryouts.com. The submission is surprisingly simple. Just upload a photo of your pet in its cutest form while wearing those iconic Cadbury bunny ears. So you have to, put bunny ears on your thing. I mean, why not?
I don't know.
$5,000?
I feel a little strange taking advantage of my pets like that, but.
But if you win.
But they could be insta-famous.
Then your pets would be, you know, putting in the time and effort to help out other pets, because, you know, that $5,000 goes to a animal shelter of your choice, you know?
All right.
And I mean, and think of all the catnip you can buy for $5,000. I think we're here for this. Absolutely. And I think that's also the best way to end Food News Update. Take that to the mill with you today. Oh my God. A question that I love to ask that always prompts a really interesting answer. Do you think there's a cross-section between being queer and food? We often talk about queer food, and what does that mean here on the podcast? Any thoughts on this?
Such a good question. I mean, I definitely think there is something about working with food that, I'm saying this based on my experience of working in kitchens and around food and feeling like so many of the people that I've encountered on my own journey are queer. And I think that there's something about, well, two things. I think there's something about the environment of in our industry where it draws weirdos, it draws like misfits, it draws like weird, you know, people who are kind of like, if not like gender queer or queer in their sexual orientation, just having a different, like a slightly different perspective, right? And I think it does like really something about working in food draws a certain kind of person out. And the second thing I think is, I think, you know, working in food, it's a very, it's like an, even though the industry can oftentimes be super toxic, like you've said, mm-hmm. toxic and harmful, there is something about working in food that is like really nurturing and about care. And I think that's something that queer people know about in a different way, because you oftentimes that's like how you survive, is by caring for each other. And I think especially in the last couple few years with the pandemic, I think we've seen this focus or this recommitting to food as a way to care for our communities and serve our communities, because I think that's the other thing is, you know, I believe so much in any kind of leadership as a form of service, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And going back to care, I just feel like one of the reasons why food is so important to any community, but especially marginalized communities, is that it is such a visceral, tangible way for us to take care of each other.
So, basically the heading was, you know, chosen family here, right, mm-hmm. is the best family, right? In the sense of like creating the community around you when you may not have the support behind you from like blood relatives and whatnot, creating that circle, right? Which often happens not only around the dinner table, but also in these restaurants, right? Mm-hmm. Right? Because it's like you said, it's a community of a very specific type of person that like mm-hmm. does this work and knows how to excel at this work. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I mean, we talk about restaurants as, you know, your restaurant family. We use that term all the time. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, as a kind of chosen family, in the same way a queer, you know, your queer family is chosen. And I think there is a similar, you know, I think that is a similar kind of repurposing and maybe, you know, finding empowerment in that term family, because, you know, a lot of times queer people are estranged from their blood relatives or, you know, have come from very challenging family situations. So, I think it's like an interesting parallel to think of restaurant families and queer, you know, I think there is definitely,
I don't think we've also gone down this road. Well, I've gone down so many roads with this question, and I always love the answer, because, you know, sometimes, especially with the people that don't know what to do with it, like, you're fantastic, but there's some people get really stumped, and it's just a really fun kind of like, you know, conversation starter. Mm-hmm. Speaking of restaurant family, do you serve good family meals? Or is it a bucket of bones and a side of
no,
rice?
No, no, no. Oh, God, no. No, no. We do.
We've all been there.
For sure. I remember picking through stock bones to serve meat, you know, for family meal, of course. Mm-hmm. But we do. We take care of our, you know, we take care of our people. I was thinking about the last one. I'm really into like... I'm using this word so ironically, so I hope no one takes me seriously, but I'm really into like exploring fusion these days. Like I'm really kind of bringing it back in our family meal. So I made like a bolognese the other day, and I made it with like lo mein noodles, and it was really good. And then I was just like reading a food magazine, and there's this whole thing about bringing fusion. I don't know. I'm in a place right now where I'm interested in how to combine different foods from different countries, different regions, influences in a way that is still, I don't know, that still feels personal, authentic, whatever that fucking means, authentic to me.
Yeah, but I love that it comes out in family meal. There's nothing better.
Right.
In your mouth, listeners, if you've never worked in a restaurant, family meal is the meal that they serve you before your like 10-hour shift, right? And I have had some disgusting, disgusting family meals, like leftover pasta with cans of tuna and black olives and whatever else they like found in the fridge and thrown in one of those plastic bins and mixed up.
And busted.
Yes, it's just like one of those bus tubs. And it's just like, wait a minute, weren't all the dirty glasses in here just like 10 minutes ago?
Yeah, like, it's a little rough sometimes.
So I always love to ask people what they're serving for family meal just because I'm a hungry bitch and I like to make sure you're taking care of your people. Before we close out, what's next for you?
Well, the aviary is and Morning Bird are open. Our dinner restaurant is open 3 nights a week currently, Thursday to Saturday. The cafe is open Thursday to Sunday. We serve breakfast and lunch.
I hear the breakfast sandwich is everything. It's all over the internet.
It's a really good sandwich, and the mochi donuts are
Yes, you know what I don't have in this apartment?
Mochi donuts
are that nice breakfast sandwich. I'm feeling very neglected.
We don't do delivery quite yet.
I'm sending an Uber Eats.
And we're gonna the restaurant's pretty new. We just opened last fall, so we're gonna try and get some more traction with the restaurant, potentially open for another night or two. And kind of just get to a place where we're like crushing it, you know. Awesome. I really feel excited about this year. I think it took a while to get a good team, you know, together. I mean, you know, everywhere it's finding people to work is challenging in restaurants right now. So I feel like we have a good team coming together, and we're just trying to take things up another level.
Well, that's amazing, and I wish you all the success. Right. And it seems
Thanks
to be
so
working.
Much.
It seems to be working. Thank you so much for your giving me of time out of your busy schedule. It's such an honor to have you here and talk to you and just commune. Let the kids know if they want to follow you or they want to find you, give them all the handles to all the things.
Yeah, we're on Instagram at Morning Bird. Oh God. I think it's just Morning Bird for the cafe. And the aviary Kinderhook is the restaurant handle. My personal handle is Hannah Chorung, which is my middle name.
Lovely, lovely, lovely. Yes, it's at Morning Bird Kinderhook and at the Avery Kinderhook.
Yep.
And then Hannah Chorung.
Yeah, there we go.
And I'll link that out. Sorry, I just pulled it. I had it up already. I'm usually not that prepared. But it was up since we were chatting before we got on here. Thank you again for being here. In Your Mouth listeners, go show Chef Hannah all the love. And if you are in upstate New York, go check out any of her restaurants and send me photos or, you know, just get a takeout bag and bring it down to Times Square. It's only a couple hours away, right? Other than that, have a great week. I am in Wyoming this week, I think, working. It's going to be fantastic. I've never been. I'm sure I'll have all the tales for you next week of the mountains of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And other than that, stay safe out there. Mind your phones because people are stealing them and doing things. Apparently, it's all over the news. And other than that, I mean, I have to play mom, right? Sometimes to the audience here. Mm-hmm. And other than that, as always, thank you for listening to In Yo Mouth. Oh.
Bumps.